The opinions expressed on this WebmasterRadio.fm program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of WebmasterRadio.fm. Any rebroadcast or retransmission of this program without the express written consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning and welcome back to another edition of the Cyber Law and Business Report. This is Bennett Kelly with the Internet Law Center speaking to you from sunny Southern California here in Santa Monica. We survived Carmageddon quite capably, and so court is in session. You may be seated. We have a very good show for you today. We're going to talk about a couple of numbers. First, we're going to talk about six strikes and the recent graduated response deal that ISPs and content providers struck with respect to copyright infringement. And we'll explain that in a little more detail. And we have, fortunately, we have with us from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Corrine McSherry. And then in the second segment, we have James O'Brien, who some of you may remember was with Lashback, the email compliance company, and he is now an associate publisher of Campaigns and Elections. And 2012 is fast approaching. We have the latest FEC numbers in terms of what candidates are spending, but we're also going to talk about what will the role of the online space be in the campaign, and will there be much of a shift? In the past, online campaign spending has only accounted for 1% or 2% in past elections, and even though it's close to 20% as a whole in general advertising. And so what will the role of online advertising and be in online in general be in the upcoming 2012 election? James is a political veteran, and I'm sure he'll have a lot of interesting things to say about that. But before we start, today is a significant day. We're going to start with numbers. Today, the first number is one, and that is one small step for man, one giant step for mankind. Happened today, 1969. And we actually, man landed on the moon. And Neil Armstrong made the famous statement as he stepped down from Apollo. And I actually had an experience where I was at a dinner where there was some people from the Mars Rover Project speaking. And in order to let the speakers actually get a chance to eat their meal, they asked everyone to go around the room and talk about where they were when Apollo landed. And my wife actually was in Africa, and she talked about how a lot of the Africans were very superstitious about it. In fact, anything that happened bad over the next year, they ended up blaming on the Apollo landing. But what was interesting, there was one gentleman in the room, and they asked him, "Where were you on that day?" And he said, "I was out of town. I was out of town with some guys," and that was Buzz Aldrin. So a very good line on his part. So that is the one. But let's jump to the six and the six strikes and the graduated response. With us from the Electronic Frontier Foundation is Corrine McSherry. She's the intellectual property director there, has an extensive background in intellectual property and free speech issues. Previously had been with Bingham McCutcheon, and she has her JD from Stanford. So she's definitely acclimated to our fine weather out here. Corrine, you're with us.
I am, yes. Hi.
Thank you for joining us. And Corrine just recently published a piece on what is called the graduated response deal. And why don't you tell us, what exactly is this graduated response or six strike deal that everyone's talking about?
Well, there's a lot of details which we can get into, but the big picture is that most of the major internet access providers, including probably the providers for most of the people who are listening, and the major content
Very good point.
Owner, big media, made a deal for how allegations of infringement are going to be handled. Essentially what the ISPs have agreed to do, and some of this they already did, but it was not sort of uniform and not everybody did it, and some of the things they never used to do. But at any rate, what they've agreed to do is follow a sort of series of steps when content owners send them information alleging that a given subscriber is engaging in some kind of infringement. Now, to be clear, what the content owners are going to send them is not, you know, the name and address of the subscriber, but rather the subscriber's IP address, because that's all they know. And basically, the service providers can use that information to match it up with an actual subscriber, and then they can contact that subscriber in a variety and respond in a variety of ways that begin with basically a sort of intimidating educational alert and ends with they have a variety of options, but includes slowing down the person's service, cutting out their web access until they go to a landing page that provides them with, you know, various kinds of information, and in other ways sort of interfering with the subscriber's service.
Now, YouTube has started something like that. They have that little copyright video. It's kind of like, you know, their version of Traffic School.
Yeah, they do. What they have, what YouTube did a little while ago is put in place a system where if you receive a takedown notice under the DMCA, basically something targeting your video that says that you've engaged in some kind of infringement, you have to go to copyright school. And then once you go to copyright school, you can, you know, potentially get your content back up if you counter notice. But the point is, you still have to go to copyright school, and that really means that you have to watch a video that tells you, that gives you information about copyright, and is, in my view, you know, very misleading in the information that it provides. And then you have to take a little quiz. And so, yeah, that is their little version.
Just like Traffic School.
Yeah, this is a little bit different. In the sense that it has, well, there's a whole variety of steps. And the other thing is, we don't know yet what the educational component is going to be. If you look at what is on, the deal sets up a copyright information center. And if you look at what's on that information center now, again, I fear that if this is a portent of things to come, consumers are going to get some pretty biased information about copyright law as part of this educational process. You know, part of the idea, which I think is not, you know, wrong, is that it may be that subscribers there may be some infringing activity that's happening on their account, and they may not know about it. And it seems to me that that's perfectly fine to let people know so that they can take steps if they need to. You know, if you're a mom and you've got a teenage boy, you might want to know what he's up to. But there's a lot of other components to the deal that are much more serious and much more severe. And one of the concerns that we have at EFF is that, subscribers are going to be paying for this, and they didn't have a chance to participate in figuring out, in participate in making the deal, and they won't have a chance to participate in implementing it.
Now, this happens in the context where in Europe, for example, France has actually taken a more draconian approach, although apparently unsuccessfully, I believe it's a 3 strikes and you're out, and you're actually disconnected from the internet, and to a great deal of criticism.
Quite right, and Ireland has its own version of the deal. I mean, there's been a big push internationally to put these various kinds of measures in place, and I think, but also an enormous outcry from subscribers who are very concerned, because if you think about what we're talking about here, I mean, this is your internet access. I mean, like cutting off your phone. People need their phone. People need their internet. We use it for all kinds of things. This is in no way a luxury, but it's a sort of a basic utility.
And wasn't there a European body that more or less said that access to the internet is somewhat, to a certain degree, a human right?
I believe that's right.
And so when we talk about, you know, the ISPs making a deal and this being pushed, the people pushing this would be, I guess, the primarily the motion picture and television and recording studios.
Exactly. They're trying. They think that this will help them fight online infringement. And to be clear, this deal is really focused very specifically on peer-to-peer. I mean, their definition, you know, they sort of make some reference to other kinds of online infringement, but they're really talking about peer-to-peer file sharing and allegations of infringement using peer-to-peer software. And that actually is something that I worry about a little bit with this so-called educational component, because I fear that one of the things that consumers are going to be told and subscribers are going to be told is that, or at least they'll get the impression that peer-to-peer, the technology itself, is evil and leads to all kinds of bad things. But in fact, the technology itself is not the problem, right? I mean, you could use it.
Technology is neutral.
The technology is neutral, and in fact, peer-to-peer technology is used for all kinds of great things. I mean, NASA uses BitTorrent. So, speaking of space missions.
Exactly. And so, in terms of where we stand in the process, has this been... is this a done deal, or is this actually, is there still any debate to be had, or?
Well, it's been, I mean, the deal has been made, and, you know, with, partially under government auspices, there's sort of, you know, various government representatives have kind of blessed it. But it isn't in place yet. This is sort of, what's been released is the Memorandum of Understanding. Here's what we've all agreed to after negotiating for several years, which they have been doing. But there's still some steps to be taken to put it in place. They need to, they're creating this sort of group to oversee the whole thing, the Center for Copyright Information. They need to appoint an executive committee and an advisory board, you know, formulate the educational materials and so on. So there's several steps to go, and which means that there's still time, I think, for subscribers to raise their voice if they're concerned about the contents of the deal. You know, it's unfortunate they didn't have the opportunity to raise their voice earlier by being included in these conversations in some way. But nonetheless, there's still time now.
And, In terms of some of the other participants, I mean, I think you referenced that Governor, I almost said Attorney General Cuomo. Governor Cuomo was one of the people involved. Was that when he was governor or was Attorney General?
He's Attorney General.
And so who else was involved besides the ISPs and the were any interest groups invited to the table?
Not that we're hearing about publicly. Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, you know, is taking credit actually for brokering this. So I think he was most definitely involved. And, you know, I suspect that various other kind of government officials were keeping an eye on and were in the loop and in part of the conversation. I mean, this thing's been going on for a long time. It's been negotiated since, I think, 2008. And it just took a long time to get everybody on board. Not surprisingly, because it's a pretty, you know, pretty major thing to work out, which also means that there was plenty of opportunity to invite subscriber representatives, but I do not believe that that happened. I think that the idea was perhaps that the ISPs would represent their subscribers, but that is really kind of contradictory. And it doesn't appear that the government officials that were involved, to the extent that they were taking seriously their obligation to also represent those subscribers. Interests. But there's an executive committee being set up, and one of the things that they could do with this deal is they could make sure that that executive committee, right now the what's contemplated is that there will be representatives from the ISP side and the big content side, but really what we need is a representative, voting members of that committee should be consumer interest groups. There is a provision for an advisory board that could consider, that could include members from consumer interest communities. But that's just an advisory board, right? What we need is someone who actually has a vote. And, you know, that's really, because again, the reality is the costs of this are going to be passed on to the subscribers, right? This is the way it always works.
Is there
and
a prior model for this?
To me, the subscribers are
going to
be paying for it. They should have a voice.
Is there any prior model for anything similar? I mean, I'm thinking, kind of quasi-governmental, but not, ICANN-ish. What is there to draw upon from past experience?
Well, I mean, I guess you could look to ICANN, as although that's a little scary. But ICANN, I think, has a reputation of being kind of sometimes not a very efficient organization. But so I'm not sure that's the model we want to look to. But you know, I don't know that there's really a comparable model for this. You know, I think they're going to be forging new territory here, and which means it's going to be really important to see how it gets set up. And also another thing that's going to be important is that there be transparency, which unfortunately right now there isn't much provision for that, so that subscribers can know, for example, there's all sorts of reports that are supposed to be generated, for example, but it's not clear that those are going to be, and it looks like they're not going to be available to the public, so that people can sort of evaluate whether this whole system is working, whether it's effective, whether it's not effective, how much it's costing, and so on.
Now, in a different context, I might say, well, I mean, you always have Congress to look over their shoulder, but in this context, you know, Congress has pretty much been aligned with the content providers heavily in the last couple of Congress, it seems, you know, with the what was known as the Internet censorship bill from last year that seems to have morphed into something this year.
Right. I mean, this is an entirely private discussion, right, and an entirely private process that is being set up. And that, I think, that's a little bit disturbing. There's been a real push in from Washington to encourage what are called, you know, voluntary measures. And the idea is that, you know, we don't want to legislate. We want people to do this on their own, come up with their own solutions, and not, we don't want to dictate from Washington. And that sounds very nice, but what it also means is that there isn't really an avenue for regular citizens to have a voice in the negotiations in the way that, at least theoretically, there is when it happens in Congress.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more about the graduated response and six strikes after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Oh, yeah. My day is done. Time for happy hour.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use CertifiedKnowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one-stop shop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. TopSEOs sends you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let TopSEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
MySEOTool.com is your all-in-one SEO management resource. MySEOTool.com makes it easy to optimize and oversee all of your SEO efforts. Line-by-line detailed reports help you identify any problems and show you how to fix them. MySEOTool.com is completely automated. Once you use it, you will see a rise in your search rankings and traffic. Try MySEOTool risk-free today. Go to MySEOTool.com. MySEOTool.com.
Rock the world with LinkedIn. Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, or on demand anytime inside the Internet Marketing Channel. Only on WebmasterRadio.fm. The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back. This is Bennett Kelly here again, and we're talking about the graduated response, or the six strikes for copyright infringement on the internet. And Kareem, what is the content provider's expectation as to what type of impact this might have?
Well, I think that they think that this will lead to folks not. I think their hope is that it will lead to a reduction in peer-to-peer file sharing of content where that file sharing isn't authorized by the law or by them. I think that's the hope.
Hey, but is it, you know, they expect it to be, you know, an overwhelming, or just is this something that's a benefit at the margins, or they really think this will stop that type of activity?
I don't think that they expect it's going to. I mean, no one can realistically expect that it's going to stop folks sharing music, and, you know, legally or illegally. I think that's unlikely in the extreme. But I think that they think that it will slow it down, and, you know, sort of at least cut down the amount of unauthorized activity that's happening out there.
Now, how successful have the measures they've been taking to date been?
You mean in other countries?
Yes.
Oh, or do you mean the United States? I mean, they've done a couple things so far. I mean, the music industry in particular, their approach was two steps. First, they sued the companies and sued several companies out of existence, and then they sued individual users. And that turned out to be pretty much a disaster. It was, very expensive.
I saw some data about the amount that they were spending per user in legal fees, and it was astronomical.
And it was a sort of public relations disaster, as you can imagine. Sort of suing music right. fans as your business model is not a very good idea. So they stopped that in 2008 and then started these negotiations with the ISPs. So if you look at what they've done, so those are the things they've done so far. And I would have to say that I do not think they've been incredibly successful. because it's still true that music fans have, are still sharing music, and they're just using different kinds of programs for doing it. And realize too that you don't have to use peer-to-peer to share music, right? There's all kinds of other ways that you can do it, and that people are doing it now. And really, what you need to do is you need to compete with free. You need to give people a better and more interesting option. And then they will, they will be interested in pursuing legal alternatives, but you have to make those good. And the record companies in particular have been very, very slow, or were very, very slow to get there, to sort of agree to the options that actually might be appealing to people. There are better alternatives now than there were 10 years ago, that's for sure. There's better alternatives now than there were 5 years ago. But if there had been better alternatives 5 years ago, 10 years ago, if they hadn't been so slow, I do think that they would have, managed to address this problem more quickly and more easily than what we're going to see with this whole elaborate system.
Now, it's interesting when you said suing your clients is not necessarily a very good business model. I'm reminded of the fact of another area in copyright where the Electronic Frontier Foundation is also very active, and that's with Righthaven. And mm-hmm. not only did that not work, but it also proved to be a public relations disaster all around for them as well.
It sure has turned into that. Well, there's, we can talk. I'm happy to talk about Righthaven. There's all kinds of shenanigans that goes on over there. I think that there was this idea that Righthaven, in addition to the legal problems, which we can talk about with Righthaven, but there was also the public relations problem. I think that Righthaven had a notion that they would persuade newspapers that these lawsuits were the way to go in terms of encouraging people not to repost news. But I don't think that that's what's happened at all. Instead, what we've got is a public relations disaster because they've been so indiscriminate about who they've sued. They've gone and, they've sued political forums. They've sued political campaigns. They sued all kinds of, small little guys who really seem very unobjectionable. And when people find out about that and realize that that's who's being sued here, it leaves everyone with kind of a bad taste in their mouth.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of the kind of the lance or the first cut that ended up leading to a bloody flow for Righthaven was inflicted by EFF on behalf of Democratic Underground, was it not?
EFF and we have fantastic co-counsel with us, and we're working on two different Righthaven cases, and we work with Fenwick and Bill West on that, and also Wilson Sonsini on the two different cases. And what emerged when we moved into discovery was that Righthaven basically did not have its ducks in a row by a long shot. They did not get the appropriate copyright assignments. They didn't set themselves up appropriately so that they would have the right to go around suing folks. And so that means that they didn't have standing. Basically, it means, you know, they didn't have the right to go to court. And they actually just got sanctioned last week for that, because the court, one of the judges that we were before, is very concerned about this. And, you know, it looks to us like what's been happening here is something that is deceitful. And so he sanctioned Righthaven for engaging in that activity. And so that, it's really been a problem. And so what Righthaven's been doing is it keeps trying to revise the agreement to see if they can fix it, if they can fix this problem.
Right. And really, one judge just laughed and said, you can't change jurisdiction retroactively. Either you had it when you came into this court or you didn't.
Right.
And exactly. Was that the one in your case?
Right. And just think about it. I think that was an order that just came out in a different case. You know, they have so many cases going that they get hit with orders right and left. They've got a lot to defend. But that's actually one of the things that's made the courts particularly concerned, is that it's, you know, our understanding that this sham assignment applies not just to our cases, but they filed over 200 cases.
Right.
And it is likely that it applies to most, if not all, of these other cases as well. So it's not just about our clients. It's about, they've been going around suing all kinds of people, again, on a sham basis. So the effect of this is very broad.
And what surprised me is, you know, I'm glad you guys defended Democratic Underground, but you know, some groups like Drudge, it seemed like he would have had the means to fight them. I was surprised he didn't.
Well, you know, that's one of the things about these suits.
It was a nuisance.
There's these kinds of lawsuits, is that a lot of people are going to make the determination that it's just not worth it to pay a lawyer to defend yourself, the amount of money that you would have to spend.
How could they ever come to that conclusion?
I know, really. Imagine. But, you know, it's not everybody can get pro bono lawyers. That's what our clients have. But most people don't have access to that. And, you know, there aren't that many pro bono intellectual property lawyers out there, I'm afraid. There's, you know, some, but not enough to cover all of these people who are being sued. And so they're going to make a determination that it's just better to, you know, pay a few thousand dollars to Righthaven and have it all go away than to get involved in a legal fight. And that's really too bad. But I mean, it's rational, but it's unfortunate, but I think it's also one of the things that Righthaven was banking on, that they wouldn't have to actually do real litigation, and, you know, which means that they wouldn't have to reveal this sham assignment that they had. But turns out they guessed wrong.
Well, was the DU case that you guys took, was that the first major contested case they had, or had anyone fought them much before?
I think that there were one or two other ones that were getting pushed as well. I'm trying to think a little bit about the timing, but I do think that, you know, we really gave them a run for their money, and we were the ones that managed to get that document out in discovery.
And then the whole house of cards fell apart.
And the whole house of cards fell apart.
We're running a little bit short on time. I one thing I neglected to say is, you could just tell us a little bit about what the EFS is and what are some of the projects it has right now.
Well, we are a digital rights organization, and essentially we're sort of the 911 of the internet. And people turn to us when they have legal problems that relate to to new technologies. And so we are doing a whole lot of different things trying to make sure that the law turns out right and that, as we often say, the Constitution makes it intact onto the Internet.
And you guys have done a great job, definitely, with Right Haven. Corinne, I want to thank you for coming on board. And what's your next big project?
Oh, gosh, I have so many going on at the moment. It's hard to narrow down on one. We are still focusing on the Right Haven issues and filing a variety of amicus briefs around the country in the next little while, addressing a whole host of Internet issues and particularly questions about intermediary liability and basically whether one of the things I worry about a lot is what I call the weakest link, which is when intellectual property complaints lead to the takedown of legal content.
And what do you do in that case?
Well, we do a number of different things. When it involves copyright, we get involved directly, and we try to. Sometimes we counsel individuals about what their options are. We do a lot of counseling in that way, and sometimes we get involved directly. When it's trademark, it's more difficult. Sometimes we have to go ahead and get involved in litigation because there is no sort of counter-notice procedure for trademark. And so what happens sometimes is that the intermediaries will say, look, you work it out amongst yourselves. We really can't help you. And, you know, that's when you really need a lawyer to step in and either, you know, respond with hopefully you can get it resolved informally via letter writing, but sometimes you have to go to court and actually do some litigation and get a declaratory judgment that says what you're doing is legal.
And, well, thank you very much for joining us today. Now, Corinne McSherry, she has an article on the graduate response on the Electronic Frontier Foundation website, which is at EFF.org. And it's co-authored with Eric Goldman, the professor from Santa Clara, who's also been on the show before. And so if you're interested in that, check it out. We'll post a link on it as well. And again, check out the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They've been very active in this space. And on the issue of copyright, as well as a number of other digital issues. And so I encourage you to check out their website, EFF.org. Corinne, thanks again for joining us, and I hope you'll consider joining us again.
Well, thanks very much. It's been fun.
All right. When we come back after this break, we will have James O'Brien to talk about the election landscape for the online world after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Looking for an affiliate network that can package every solution an advertiser or publisher needs in one account? Your one-stop source for full-service solutions is AdMedia.com. AdMedia delivers an incredible lineup of specialized XML feeds for local, social, and search, plus the advertising arsenal of PPC, SEM, contextual, display, and more. AdMedia gives your campaign real visibility, from emailers to domain redirects. AdMedia tailors your all-in-one campaign to give your account a real advantage. AdMedia.com delivers cost-effective ad solutions with real conversions. Learn everything AdMedia can do for you today. Sign up at AdMedia.com. AdMedia, strong ROI made simple.
Looking for a white-label SEO and social platform for your clients? Think
eBrands.
Free and unlimited SEO audit reports.
eBrands.
Premium Facebook apps and welcome page creators.
eBrands.
Twitter management app, analytics, and mobile site generators.
eBrands.
Let eBrands manage your search and social media campaigns and give you and your clients access to their white label dashboard, which have great reports that will wow your clients and deliver great ROI and results. Try eBrands for 30 days. Go to eBrandsWithAZ.com or call 1-866-625-5717. That's eBrands with a Z for
eBrands.
On the road. On the boat. Working out. Or up in the air. Now you can listen to WebmasterRadio.fm on the go from anywhere. Look for WebmasterRadio.fm on TuneIn. Available for download on your iPhone, iPad, BlackBerry, Android, Palm, Samsung, and Windows Phone, as well as Google TV, Yahoo TV, and Roku. Tune in to WebmasterRadio.fm on the go from anywhere by downloading TuneIn right now. Webmasterradio.fm. We really are everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back for our second segment, and we have with us an old friend. Many of you may know James O'Brien. Used to be the marketing director at Lashback, the email compliance firm, and leading in the canned spam compliance space. He's since left Lashback and has joined the distinguished magazine of Campaigns and Elections, and as their associate publisher. And one sure way to know if someone's thinking about running for office is they have that in their hand. And so James offers a huge advantage for us because he can speak to both the political realities of what's going on in this upcoming election, as well as have a detailed knowledge of the online space. James, are you with us?
Yes, I sure am, and thanks for having me on, Bennett.
It's great to hear from you again. Now, James, it's definitely going to be an interesting year, but I'm hearing some huge numbers that a candidate can expect to spend $1 billion just to get through the nomination process.
I think some of those numbers are a little bit off. I mean, Karl Rove did an interesting article yesterday for Fox News, sort of arguing that Obama won't get to $1 billion, with his fundraising. That's been sort of over to that $1 billion mark. It's certainly, when you think of political online or just advertising spending at all in the context of all advertising dollars, it's still a relatively small percentage. I mean, more money is sort of market bubblegum and hairspray, than we are our leaders, who are making some of the most important decisions in the world for us out there. And their marketing is just sort of come around and get a little bit more sophisticated and get those budgets there, so candidates can actually get their message out and through the clutter to the voting public.
Now, Moody's is projecting a budget, I think, of in the neighborhood of $2.7 billion will be spent in political ads in this cycle. Is that more or less what you've been hearing?
Yeah, I think overall, I mean, we'll definitely eclipse the $2 billion mark this cycle. I think it's still far smaller percentage of it will be in online dollars. I know in past cycles, search still sort of dominated more than half, about 60% of the spending in the last major presidential cycle.
And what's interesting is that I looked at latest data, and I think online advertising accounts for 18%. Of overall advertising in the the hairspray bubblegum world, to use your analogy, and
sure.
But I think the projections for 2012 are 2% of the political market, and what accounts for this great disparity?
And that's exactly what we're seeing in talking to firms that are doing the actual buying and just looking at the data. Some of the larger races, can extrapolate a percentage. That's a little more meaningful. I think. In New Jersey, we saw last cycle the gubernatorial campaign, both spent, I think, under $500,000, a pretty sizable budget online. Meg Whitman in California recently did about, I think she did over $3 million, which was still, I think it was about that 3% of her overall ad budget. So.
Why the disparity? What is it about political advertising that doesn't lend itself as well to the online space as, say, soap?
Yeah, so a big part of it, I think, is traditional media consultants, I think, still dominate spending the decisions. And if you want to reach, guaranteed to reach, enough voters to win an election, people are still looking at radio and television, whether broadcast or cable, by far. So one of the things that we're seeing happening, though, is the sophistication level of the agencies and also the ability of some of the actual websites like Google AdSense to sort of offer a self service, if you will, is what's really going to start to drive those numbers up a little bit. So we're seeing more agents, you know, far more sophisticated technology people working at them. They're not just political hacks, but also, you know, do email and maybe put up a website. You know, you've been following how Obama has been putting together, you know, one of the most sophisticated online data departments that's probably ever been put together for any political campaign anywhere near their Chicago headquarters. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what we're actually going to do with that.
Yeah, there's actually this. I want to get into that in a minute, but just for the listeners, you know, James, you have a background. I didn't really explain it, but you have a background as a political consultant prior to going into the online space.
Yeah, I've done close to 200 campaigns in 26 different states, and it was really before getting into the online space. So, you know, is doing a lot of traditional media and a lot of sort of operational, you know, tactical stuff. So now, it's been fascinating to go into technology and then to D.C. see where the goal online landscape is. So it's always been, you know, behind certainly, you know, what the corporate advertising world is doing.
And on that point, I mean, one of the issues, unlike corporate advertising, where you learn from what you did last month, in the political world, you learn what you did last cycle, which could be 2 years ago, 4 years ago. And, you know, and here's a case where I've noticed that, you know, they tend to fight the last war. And so I'm sure right now everyone's focusing on social media to the extent they didn't do so last time, when maybe that they should be focusing on mobile. And did you observe that at all?
Yeah, you know, I think it was interesting watching Facebook hire Katie Harbath, who had been sort of an online guru here in D.C. and had done some really great work for Giuliani, to go out there and actually educate the consultants about what they, you know, can really do. And, you know, and how often, I mean, the regulations around putting up a 30-second spot on a network, it's not hard to navigate your way through, and it really hasn't changed that much, you know, in the last 10 or 20 years. Whereas, you know, Facebook and the rules around, you know, what type of page you have and how you use it, you know, has, you know, changes on, you know, almost a weekly basis.
Right.
So, again, it's another thing for a lot of the traditional consultants that are used to doing things one way. They know how to do direct mail. They know how to do network television buying. You know, are having more trouble, definitely, understanding how to not just get online advertising executed, but then how to do it effectively.
You know, I remember actually doing when I was with ValueClick, doing a run to Washington in 2004, just trying to see what type of dollars we could get on this. And it you know, people really were still in the you know, 1990s in terms of what their outlook of the internet was. And, you know, just trying to educate them as to what was possible. It really seemed like it was going to take a number of years, and clearly it has. But one thing I've always been interested in, and this kind of touches on your earlier comment, James, in that the inability, I think, of the online space to capture a larger share of the ad market, I've always wondered as that changes and as that grows and as the members see greater results from online ads, particularly as you move into areas such as behavioral or social, and to what extent that might affect policy views? And are you going to be more likely to regulate behavioral advertising when you realize that it may have helped you win that last primary?
I see it as one of the greatest threats, actually, right now to some of those elected officials making policies on the Hill and looking at the disconnect. I think there's some really incredible firms out there, like, whether it's Revolution Messaging on the Democratic side group, or Connell Donatelli, Kraft Media, you know, on the Republican side, you know, that really understand the compliance issues and have people that they're investing in their education to understand how to be compliant, how to do those things correctly. You know, there's still, you know, in that sort of middle ground, you know, we're going to have less consistency around that and a general lack of knowledge, I think, of a lot of the laws that govern, you know, simple, you know, if one campaign wants to share their email list with another, I don't think they're really cognizant of what their, you know, of what their privacy policy website said if they were allowed to share that data.
Although, been, you know, if you have noticed, a lot of the political stuff is usually exempt from that type of regulation. But it is, I mean, it's interesting because at this very moment, you know, these issues are being debated in Congress. I think there's a markup today, I think, on a data breach bill. And so privacy is very much front and center on Capitol Hill this year. And right at the moment when, you know, all these candidates are also telling their consultants to drum up money and drum up support online.
So I'll make a prediction, you know, with all the, you know, with Sony Entertainment's data breach and all the press that it has gotten, we will not get through this next cycle without a major scandal around data privacy and use with an elected official. And whether or not it might actually, you know, be someone sort of involved in the process, I would hope that they're, you know, taking care of things a little bit better. But, you know, I think your average campaign that's out there, it'd be a challenge for them to be compliant. And there are some, you know, exceptions with, you know, can spam, you know, a political speech. But at the same time, if a campaign is going to sell paraphernalia, they're bound to be compliant with the Can Spam Act. It's a commercial.
Frankly, the developments in the past year in terms of hacking, you know, with Anonymous and some of the other groups, you know, have been quite alarming. And, you know, so I wouldn't be surprised to see a member of Congress get targeted or a campaign or a DNC, RNC, you know, have something catastrophic happen, you know, from, you know, either, you know, from a political point of view. And,
I agree with that. In fact, you know, it's been the Sony CEO has been lamenting, you know, that, you know, they've taken so much criticism when they were targeted so severely. And I don't know many organizations, including some of our defense agencies and important governmental agencies, that have also been, you know, hacked. And if you're
CIA,
really targeted,
NATO,
you know, how do you avoid
NSA,
that?
Yeah. What's
but I'm
the,
also thinking of just sort of unforced errors, you know, of a campaign
exactly,
you know, not securing a website properly or using the wrong data. And sort of getting caught, you know, just making a sort of a blatant compliance mistake.
It's kind of like if you're a Cubs fan, it's like that fan reaching in and taking that ball. You know, and,
it's like, don't do that.
I'm sorry. It's just that, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you can do your best you can, and you can still have stuff like that happen. And, you know, and I'm in some ways, the one thing I look at this whole Murdoch scandal is that, you know, people may have been taking hacking very lightly. And when you put that in context and, you know, away from the whole political aspect of Murdoch, but in context with what's going on, you know, with the, you know, they just busted 16 people earlier this week as part of the Anonymous ring. And that this is really kind of a serious and growing threat to, you know, our daily lives and to business, that, you know, this is something that shouldn't be taken lightly, and that, you know, some people need to be made an example, and just
and,
so
and,
that
and
people
could,
don't think it's a funny
a
thing to do.
You're putting on Campaign Tech, which will be a new seminar that we're doing in November here in Washington, D.C., it's at campaigntechconference.com. And a big piece of that is going to be bringing in counsel, because when we talk about compliance in politics, it's usually around fundraising and
right.
money out of federal campaigns and that stuff. So we're going to be talking about compliance for data security, you know, the proper use of email and mobile, which I think is really sort of skipping that maybe skipped a generation in the corporate world. We front and center. You know, for many of the political races, and I think it's going to be the channel to watch, where a lot of the sort of new creative applications of mobile technology, from companies like TMI Mobile, are going to be at the forefront this cycle.
Well, I was reading that every candidate should have their own mobile app. You know, they should have you should be in touch with your constituent or, you know, your supporters, and they should have your app on their phone. I mean, I don't know to what extent that's being done, but I saw some consultants say that it should be done.
The conservative victories in the recent federal Canadian elections, most of those campaigns actually had their own mobile app. And just in terms of transparency, T-My Mobile is a major advertiser for campaigns and elections. But we like them because they're really democratizing the technology, and their advancement is really in pushing down the price point, you know, from something that has cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to field and maintain to something that's now basically going to cost hundreds. And with that, you know, you're going to see a lot more campaigns using that technology, using it well, but then there's also going to be, you know, the errors. And those errors, as we know, can sometimes mean, you know, serious violation of serious federal laws. So part of what we want to do with Campaign Tech in November is really educate around those issues, but also just in general to make sure that, you know, the consultants and the agencies that are here in Washington, D.C. and across the world, really, you know, are as on top of compliance issues and all this technology, you know, as the agencies are in the corporate world.
Now, campaigns and elections, you just recently, you were bought by a UK company?
Yeah, Biteback Media, which publishes Total Politics in the UK, which is more of a political lifestyle magazine, not unlike maybe some people would remember George here in the United States.
I was going to say, yeah.
A bit more sophisticated, though, I think, in of their brand and their content. And, of course, Campaigns and Elections is really sort of the B2B publication.
Yeah.
So it's about the industry for the industry. You know, we're not really focused on policy or people that much, you know, unless to the extent that consultants and those individual sort of characters in our industry, you know, are doing, you know, interesting things with technology or media or what have you.
Although I've seen some pretty brilliant things on your blog on in terms of the political side, but any event, the in terms of you know, what you're looking at in 2012 as the kind of the next big thing, what do you think that will be?
Yeah, like I think it's definitely mobile. I think you're going to see it take on sort of a life of its own as people realize that, you know, everyone is sitting there. Talk to some of the larger, you know, media networks, and they're worried because, you know, I know I'm sitting there at night, you know, with the news on, but I have my iPad in one hand and my BlackBerry in the other, and I'm messaging people and getting information, so there's two screens between myself and the television set. So, you know, it's a traditional media to figure out how to get in the middle of that connection, too, and how to be part of that dialogue.
But yeah, I think
the good news is those companies are definitely thinking about that problem. So I hope we'll see some sort of innovative solutions around that.
So if you're a candidate, does that mean you recognize that obviously the TV is the shotgun and I'm going to get the biggest bang, but through mobile I can kind of measure engagement, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, you know, how many, you know, the campaigns, do they really have the time, and this has been part of the issue, to delve into their analytics? I mean, certainly the bigger races, the presidential, you know, the larger, you know, statewide in like California, Meg Whitman, so they have a department probably looking at analytics, but they're really some of the few political races that are doing that. I mean, most of them are, you know, it's a one-day sale with a very short, you know, time limit, and most of the spending done towards the end of the cycle. So analytics plays a role, but not in the same way that it does you know, in the campaign world that we're used to, the more traditional online. So I think it's also been, you know, part of the issue for online spending being able to take more budget away from other media channels like it has in the corporate world.
Well, James, I'm being given the hook here, and but I want to thank you for joining us on short notice, and you know, I hope you'll consider joining us again, and definitely keep us up to date on the Campaign Tech in November. We'd like to hear how that goes. Everyone, that was James O'Brien with Campaigns and Elections. James, what's your website?
It's campaignsandelections.com.
So please join us next. We will be taking a week off next week, but we'll be back the following week on Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on Cyber Law and Business Report. This is Bennett Kelly from our Internet Law Center Media Center in Santa Monica saying court is adjourned, and we will see you next time. Thanks again. Thanks, James.